This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tanzina Vega all this week. We begin today in Brooklyn, New York, where as many as 1,600 inmates held in a federal detention facility have been without heat, light, telephone access, and access to attorneys over the past week, even as freezing temperatures swept across the Northeast.
If you do not have heat in your cell, knock on those windows! If you are hungry, you want hot food, knock on those windows!
That's the sound of inmates inside Metropolitan Detention Center banging on the facility's windows in response to protesters asking about the conditions. Family members communicated with incarcerated loved ones from the sidewalk, yelling through megaphones.
Desmond! I hear you! Are you good? Are you good? Do you have heat?
Calls for a federal response grew louder over the weekend as visits from lawmakers drew increased attention to those being held at MDC. On Sunday, demonstrators stormed the facility but were driven back by officials who pepper sprayed them. But the pressure on the federal government to address conditions worked, and last night, power returned to the facility. Stephen Nesson is a reporter here at WNYC who's been covering the story from Brooklyn, and we're also joined by Nicholas Turner, president and director of the Vera Institute of Justice, which has looked closely at the issue of extreme temperatures and unsafe conditions in federally run prisons across the country. Nick, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
We're going to start with you, Stephen. Stephen, things got pretty intense yesterday at the Metropolitan Detention Center. You brought us that amazing tape. Give us a rundown of what you saw.
Right. So you heard that banging on the windows. That's when you arrive at the facility, that's kind of the first thing you hear. It's just the steady, like, drumbeat of hands on glass. And pretty much starting last Thursday, I believe, it really was brought to the public's attention that this facility hasn't had power for nearly a week. Heat was out. We had this frigid temperatures. I think the families of people who are in there were aware of the problem, but I think the general public became more aware of it last week. And elected officials rushed down there and protests began to grow. And you can actually access sort of the outside quite easily. You just go down a driveway. And so family members, protesters have been putting up signs with, you know, their family members' names on it. We love you. We're watching you. This is not right. And the protests have been gathering. And then Sunday is when you heard the tape that I got. A lot of elected officials were showing up throughout the day. Sunday was actually the first day lawyers were allowed to go in to see their clients. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you mentioned, but these are pre-trial detainees for the most part. Some of them have been sentenced, but most of them are still awaiting trial.
They've just been charged with a crime but have not been found guilty of anything. That's most of the population inside.
Right. So lawyers needed to go see their clients because they have cases coming up.
What are the lawyers and also the elected officials who have been able to get inside, what have they said about the conditions over the last several days?
Well, right. Sunday night, power finally got restored. But before that, inmates were actually in, it was lockdown situation for the most part. So people weren't allowed to leave their cells. Huh. They were sitting in the dark because there was no electricity. And the elected officials were there all weekend touring different floors, and they were reporting that some floors actually had heat and it was pretty strong, but others absolutely had almost no heat and inmates were freezing. The city of New York actually sent, you know, a package of like 600 blankets and hand warmers, generators. And the elected officials say they didn't see any of those blankets anywhere. I mean, there are 1,600 people in this facility, and they sent 600 blankets. So, you know, it's possible they missed it. But they said the conditions were pretty dire. And with the power out, that meant they didn't have access to the computer system. And so there are reports that many people didn't have access to their necessary medicine that they needed. Some people were getting their meds, but others were not. So that was, you know, one of the big concerns.
And based on your most recent reporting, is everything back up? Hot water, heat, electricity, or is that still not clear if it's consistent throughout the facility?
The heat, I believe, is not clear. Electricity is reportedly restored.
Nick, I want to turn to you. The MDC is a facility run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which operates more than 70 facilities throughout the country. How do Bureau of Prisons facilities generally compare to other jails and other prisons throughout the country?
Well, it's actually hard to know. I mean, I think the first thing that I want to start out by saying is that when you think about prisons and jails in this country and the fact that we have 2.2 million people locked up in probably around 3,000 jails in the country and around 1,500 prisons. So I'm not just talking federal, I'm talking state and local. This is sort of the crucible of two fundamentally powerful forces. One is that there is no greater government deprivation of liberty that exists than imprisoning people and then the government assuming their care. So that's one thing that happens in all of those facilities. And then the second thing is that they are absolutely non-transparent. Huh. And let's just use this as an example. It took a week with the heat off during a polar vortex in a federal jail 2 miles from Brooklyn Heights, just across the river from downtown Manhattan, with people banging on the walls and windows and federal defenders unable to see their clients, to bring this to attention in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
That is indicative of, I think, a far bigger problem that we have in jails and prisons all around the country, except the problem is that we don't really know because they are so non-transparent. It's not as if you get to walk in and observe the facilities and the conditions and be able to talk to people. These folks are under the complete control of government. And so when government officials dissemble and say everything's fine, you know, we're dealing with a power outage, but it's, you know, everything's okay. How do you actually check and confirm that?
Right. What have, though, in the past, any complaints either from attorneys who have been able to get in or from inmates themselves, what have they said about this facility even before this past week?
Again, it's hard to draw sort of big conclusions, but there was recently a trial in Brooklyn where a corrections officer had been charged with multiple counts of sexually assaulting women who were locked in that facility. So I think we're talking about a complex of conditions that far exceed lack of heat or lack of light, but actually very dangerous conditions where people's where people's physical safety is threatened.
Wow.
So can I ask you, Nick, real quick, is that rare then that elected officials would get to tour the facility? I mean, they were there on Saturday and Sunday.
Yes, I think generally it's rare for two reasons. One is that I would say that for elected officials, there's a general incuriosity about what happens to the poor and mostly people of color who are locked up in this country. I would say that that is not just an incuriosity that exists with elected officials, but with the public at large. Mm-hmm. But also, while public officials can go into jails and prisons, those visits are generally controlled. They're choreographed. And so you don't get a chance to see everything. My guess is that this federal facility is probably in better condition and is probably better resourced than lots of jails and prisons around the country and is probably more subject to scrutiny than we would see in places that are farther away from media, that are farther away from a really active, progressive government.
You said that there's a blind spot among elected officials and the public at large that we don't think about this incarcerated population. Is it possible that the situation with the MDC over the last several days is going to lead to a broader conversation about how we treat the detained population in America, and not just Bureau of Prison facilities, but county jails and state prisons and privately run facilities? Is that possible? Are we going to now have that conversation?
Look, I would like to hope so. I would like that Congress would hold hearings on this. I would like to see that this sort of maelstrom of attention actually does generate the kind of what I would describe as sort of transformational inquiries that really seek to figure out, well, how can we provide better oversight? But there's nothing new about this. Last year, there were in a disturbance in a South Carolina prison, there were 7 people murdered and over 20 injured. There have been suits against Texas prisons because they don't have air conditioning. And this is Texas.
Wow.
There was a 2013 hunger strike by people who were locked up in California prisons who were striking not only against solitary confinement conditions, but also access to health, to cleanly facilities, to decent food that didn't make people sick. So this is not a new chapter. That we have been living in this environment for a long time, and so I'm a bit skeptical that it will actually result in change. But I'm also extraordinarily grateful that a lot of elected officials have turned out and that the media has turned out, and that I'm sitting here talking with you today about this, because the light has to be shined on it.
There are national detention standards for the imprisoned populations of this country. I mean, are there any teeth to those standards? I mean, will there be any consequences for officials at this facility?
I don't know whether there'll be any consequences. I think I would say that the standards are difficult to enforce. I think that the standards exist in a broader paradigm that we have around criminal justice, which is that prisons and jails, I think the public agrees, and I would say that for decades, electeds and government officials agree, people have been completely satisfied with these places being places of deprivation and mistreatment and brutality and lack of respect for human rights. And so in that case, if that's the complex in which the standards exist, then then I think what we really need to be doing is fundamentally reimagining what these places are supposed to achieve and how you treat people who are in them as human. And we don't do a good job with that.
Just to look forward, Congressman Gerald Nadler, who's chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has said he will hold oversight hearings with the Bureau of Prisons. And I also was reading reports that a judge in the Southern District of New York will be having a meeting tomorrow to discuss with federal prison officials what she called disturbing living conditions in this prison. So there is some action happening. We'll keep an eye out for that.
We certainly will. Stephen Nesson is a reporter with WNYC. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
And Nick Turner is the president and director of the Vera Institute of Justice. Stephen and Nick, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And earlier today, the Department of Justice issued a statement on the conditions at MDC Brooklyn. They said they will work with the Bureau of Prisons to, quote, examine what happened and ensure that the facility has power, heat, and backup systems in place to prevent the problem from reoccurring.
You know, we're going to move forward from today. We'll take one day at a time. I obviously will have discussions with our caucuses, with the Republican caucuses, with the people of Virginia. And as long as I feel that I can lead, I will continue to do that. If I reach a point where I am not comfortable with that, then obviously we will sit down and have that discussion.
Ralph Northam, the Democratic governor of Virginia, has so far refused to step down after a photo emerged from his 1984 medical school yearbook page showing one person dressed in blackface and another as a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
It started with me being presented a picture from a yearbook that I had never seen before. That was horrific. And I reached out and apologized to my colleagues. I released two statements, as you know. And, you know, all I can do is what I've always done, and that's to be honest.
Northam at first said he was present in the photos. He later reversed that. Democrats have been calling on him to step down. The controversy comes as Democrats are both trying to maintain a principled stance on racism and are also close to consolidating power in the state that has slowly been turning more blue. Corey D.B. Walker is a professor at the University of Richmond. Hi, Corey, and thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Hi, Matt. I'm glad to be here with you.
Corey, what's your reaction to what we've seen in the last 72 hours in the Commonwealth of Virginia? And I'm curious your reaction not just to the Democratic governor's racist photos, but also what shocked me even more, the fact that a med school in 1984 allowed such photos to be published in a yearbook.
Just as a citizen of the Commonwealth and a citizen of the United States, I'm appalled at not only at the photo, but also at the level of consciousness of the institution that will allow graduating medical students to take photos of that matter and then to publish them in the yearbook. Whether we find them funny or performative, the question that we have to begin to engage is, what type of medical institution would see this as something to be made fun of, particularly for individuals who are going out to practice medicine in a radically plural society?
Corey, give us some context here. The national coverage focuses on this one event, but as a native Virginian and a historian, how does it fit into the state's bigger issues on race and even issues in recent history on race?
I think anyone looking at the Commonwealth of Virginia and looking at our history will understand that this is a very fraught issue and goes to the very foundations, not only of this state, but also of this nation. When you think that 2019 becomes the year where we celebrate the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans landing in English-speaking America, you're reminded that this doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens with a longer history of racial animus, a longer history of racial violence, and a longer history of anti-Black racism. When we just look at the contemporary moment, let's say the last 20 to 25 years in Virginia politics, we look at the candidacy and the campaigns of former Governor George Allen. Photos came out where he's meeting with prominent members of white supremacist organizations back in the 1990s. We look at Governor Allen again in the Macaca moment in the early 2000s when he's running for Senate. We look at the contentious senatorial campaign of 2012, looking at politics in Virginia in light of the Shelby decision in 2013. And of course, we're looking at this in light of Charlottesville. So when you take this photo, it's not just one instance. It's an instance of an incident that has built up over the course of time. And in Virginia, it is part of a deep and virulent divisive politics that has taken over the state.
Northam won in 2017 against Republican Ed Gillespie, partly because of African-American support. How do you think this story is resonating in Black communities right now across Virginia, who among people who may have voted for Northam or those who may have been wooed away from Gillespie to Northam? What is their reaction? What are their thoughts at this moment?
At this moment, it is really a betrayal. Over 80% of African Americans went for Ralph Northam, but these were pragmatic politics. And in terms of your choices, it's either Ralph Northam or Ed Gillespie, who's running an overtly racist and racialist campaign, particularly around immigration. You don't have really this full choice of candidates. But now when you have this come out, now they see that there is a choice. And that choice becomes the Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax.
Yeah, tell us about him. Yeah.
Bright, aggressive, assertive, and pragmatic and progressive politician who really has the ability to then move the state forward.
He's also a descendant of a slave, is that right?
That's right. And he carries that with him. And when it comes time for our Republican counterparts to recognize and honor Robert E. Lee, Justin Fairfax took the principal stance, not only this year, but his first year in office, of stepping down from the dais to say that this is not right. So we're seeing a principled leader who is consistent in his principled stances. And when we look at the changing stories of Ralph Northam, you see these totally opposite responses. And I think it is the responses that we see from Governor Northam compared to the responses from Justin Fairfax that has so many people in the Commonwealth saying, let's move on from this. Let us have Justin Fairfax as the next governor, and we need to continue to work on this thing we call race, not only in Virginia, but also throughout America.
Following the publication of the photos, Democrats around the country have been calling on Northam to resign. It seems like Democrats are trying to take a principled stance in this case, and the stance is that their party will not tolerate this kind of racist behavior. And then in response, you've seen some conservatives reminding their supporters that Democrats are the party of slavery and the KKK. Is that historically accurate and relevant for this conversation?
Of course not. No. The parties have changed, and that line of argument to say that the Republicans are the party of Lincoln and the Democrats are the Dixiecrats, what we have are the changing configurations of all the party structures. There's no one static party that has always been for African Americans and no one static party that has always been to the advantage for African Americans. We saw African Americans starting to leave the Democratic Party as early as 1928.
Wow.
So when we hear those conversations in public, we need to begin to think, folks, let us contextualize this and let us be realistic about our contemporary moment. And of course, when you're looking at Ralph Northam, no one is taking Ralph Northam in isolation. This is also the same conversation that we're having with our Republican colleagues, of course, with President Trump. What we're seeing here is not a party issue. This is an American issue. This is an issue that goes to the very foundations of the nation. We still have a deep, unresolved issue on the question of race, and no one party is innocent in that conversation. And it's going to require an entire nation to deal with not only a 400-year history of it, but a history of race that has made the modern world.
Corey D.B. Walker is a visiting professor at the University of Richmond. Thank you for your perspective, Corey.
Thank you so much for having me.
The NFL season came to a close on Sunday with the New England Patriots capturing their sixth Super Bowl title over the LA Rams. It was a low-scoring game, not especially exciting, complete with a fairly bland halftime show, unless you're a huge Maroon 5 fan. But for the league itself, this season was a success. Television ratings were up 5%, with a per-game average of nearly 16 million viewers. And while several players did continue to protest police brutality and racial inequality during the national anthem, on-field activism did not define the season. Quarterback Colin Kaepernick remains unsigned, and his most notable moment came back in September with a Nike ad that aired during the season opener.
If they laugh at what you think you can do, good. Stay that way.
But even as fewer players took a knee in 2018, activism continued on in the NFL. A group known as the Players Coalition, founded by Philadelphia Eagles safety Malcolm Jenkins and former Arizona Cardinals wide receiver Anquan Boldin, has pushed the league to donate money towards issues including criminal justice reform and education equity. In 2017, the NFL made a deal with the coalition to donate $89 million to social justice causes over the course of 7 years. I spoke with Doug Baldwin, a Players Coalition governing board member and wide receiver for the Seattle Seahawks. He started off by explaining how Colin Kaepernick paved the way for the Players Coalition.
Well, I think initially Kaepernick obviously brought a very bright light to some travesties that were happening in our communities and really brought the attention and the focus on those tragedies. And so I think that all of us had been kind of figuring out what we wanted to do, trying to find an avenue and a place to exert our passion and our energy in the right way. And Kaepernick kind of, you know, started that momentum. And I will say that Malcolm and Anquan kind of took the torch and led us down a further path or continuing that path as far as the players in the NFL goes. And I don't know if him not being in the NFL has anything to do with our continued work now. But, you know, obviously Kaepernick and him not having a job in the NFL when he's obviously well qualified, we talk about that as a unit. But, you know, it's the nature of the business. It is still a business at the end of the day. And so, you know, that comes with the territory.
So what are your goals for the Players Coalition? What are you specifically concerned about that you're hoping you're able to continue to address through the coalition?
The social justice sphere touches a number of different things. You know, it's police and community relations, criminal justice reform itself, education and economic advancement for low-income communities. I mean, it's all of these things. And there's a number of legislations that we supported this past year in voter rights and restoration in Louisiana and in Florida. You know, Florida, the bill that passed, the voter rights restoration, was for more than 1.5 million citizens with prior convictions in Florida. So, you know, a lot of that was just based on re-enfranchising the people who had been disenfranchised and giving them an opportunity to use their voice once again. And so that was obviously very important to us as well.
And then the biggest success from so far involving the Players Coalition is this $89 million that the NFL agreed to allocate towards the partnership and to programs that tackle social justice issues. What was the process like in terms of making that deal with the NFL?
It was an interesting process. And anybody who knows about going through a negotiation process for any type of money understands how interesting those can be. You know, but I will commend the NFL in stepping up and, you know, wanting to be a part in some way. And so, you know, we are proud of them for that. But we have received funding from a number of different foundations, Open Philanthropy, obviously the NFL Foundation, and a number of private donations. So, you know, it was an ongoing process, obviously, to get the money from the NFL. But I don't want to, you know, stand on the NFL too long and say that they were the only contributors because they weren't.
But there has been some concern around the motivations of the NFL and their involvement. Is that what ultimately caused some players to leave the coalition?
You know, to be quite honest, I have no idea. You'd have to speak to those players themselves. I will say that that was a concern of mine as well, personally, just wondering, you know, what was the true motivation behind the NFL getting behind the cause. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, right? They put up $89 million and are supporting our efforts, and we are getting to direct those efforts. And so that was really important to us, was that it was going to be player-led, because obviously we were the ones with the passion and, you know, started this whole endeavor. So, you know, at the end of the day, the funds are getting to where they need to get to.
And what organizations were chosen this year? Is there any particular one that you feel passionate about?
Communities and schools. I think that a lot of us have a passion for the social justice sphere as it pertains to providing proper education and quality education. And Communities and Schools does just that. They're a leading national organization empowering students to stay in school, utilizing a model that works directly in the schools to address and impact people who are dealing with poverty at every angle. And so that was one of the programs or organizations that I really was interested in. And obviously they were one of our grantees.
Before I let you go, I want to ask about how President Trump has seemed to want to make black football players one of his political enemies. He's, as you know, called on owners to fire players. He used an expletive to describe them, players who kneel during the national anthem to protest police violence against black people. I'm wondering if the Players Coalition is conflicted at all about how to handle Trump's attacks and these sort of random tweets that can come at you and you don't even know they're going to be coming. Is that a conversation you have and something you might be struggling with?
No. For the most part, the collective of the Players Coalition, you know, we're not conflicted on how we handle this. It really has nothing to do with our direction and what we're trying to accomplish. You know, we're going to press forward with our efforts and supporting organizations and getting boots on the ground to impact change in our communities and our society. And, you know, what our president says negatively upon that really has nothing to do with us. I would say more so it's indicative of his nature and his, you know, his state of mind. But again, you know, it doesn't change what we're trying to accomplish, and we're going to continue to push forward. So, we're not too conflicted about that at all.
And pushing forward, is the future of this movement off the field? Is that where we're going to see it? These efforts off the field to secure money for organizations in the social justice world, more so than maybe protest during the national anthem?
Well, there was never really a protest of the national anthem. And I just want to make sure that that's clear and understood. It was just a demonstration of the frustration that came with a lot of the lack of changes and lack of progress that we were seeing in our own communities. So I can't speak for everybody in terms of what's going to be on the field or, you know, what's going to continue as demonstrations. But I do know that our efforts as a Players Coalition is directed towards what we can accomplish off the field, but also utilizing our platform and the spotlight that we have, the voice that we have, to bring light to those issues that are in our community still, and also providing a voice for those who don't have the platform. And so, yes, our efforts will be primarily focused, obviously, off the field in areas where we can improve societal problems. But also, again, we're still going to use our platform whenever we have the opportunity to do so.
Doug Baldwin, Players Coalition governing board member and a wide receiver for the Seattle Seahawks. Thanks so much, Doug.
Of course. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for joining us. I'll be with you all week, filling in for Tanzina Vega, who's on vacation. If you want to weigh in on anything you heard on the show, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway.